apologies, we've had to cancel tonight's live feed due to family reasons.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Vice President Johnson has become the 36th President of the United States.
I didn't shoot anybody, sir. I haven't been told what I'm here for.
I'm just a patsy.
Supporters of Israel's nuclear weapons program were in fact involved in the JFK assassination.
There's only one person in the world that John Kennedy trusted unequivocally, and that was Robert Kennedy.
Obviously, I was there, but I don't remember any of that.
Just after midnight on the 6th of June 1968, Senator Robert Kennedy, candidate to the presidency of the United States, was shot in a back room of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. He had just been celebrating his victory at the California primaries, which made him the most likely Democratic nominee for the presidential election. Robert would probably have won against the Republican candidate Richard Nixon. At the age of 43, he would have become the youngest American president ever, after being the youngest attorney general. His death opened the way for Richard Nixon, who could finally become president 8 years after being beaten by John F. Kennedy. John had been assassinated 4 years and a half before Robert. Had he survived, he would probably have been president until 1968, and his brother might have succeeded him. Instead of that, John's vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took over the White House in 1963. He became so unpopular that he retired in 1968. Interestingly, Johnson became president the very day of John's death and ended his term a few months after Robert's death. He was in power at the time of both investigations. Both investigations are widely regarded as cover-ups. In each case, the official conclusion is rife with contradictions. We are going to sum them up in this film, but we will do more. We will show that the key to solving both cases resides in the link between them, and we will solve them beyond a reasonable doubt. Strangely, we rarely hear about the Kennedy assassinations as a plural. John's death in 1963 and Robert's in 1968 are generally treated as two unconnected tragedies, rather than as serial murders. When both killings are connected, it is by the nonsensical notion of a curse on the Kennedy family, rather than by the hypothesis of a common commissioner. This theme of the Kennedy curse, in which is included the plane accident that cost the life to John Kennedy Jr., is often associated to the alleged sins of John and Robert's father, Joseph Kennedy. A more rational explanation must take into account that John and Robert were more than just brothers. They were connected by an unshakable loyalty. All Kennedy biographers stress the absolute dedication of Robert to his elder brother. Robert had successfully managed John's campaign for the Senate in 1952, then his presidential campaign in 1960. John was deeply grateful for his support.
Great appreciation to my brother Bobby, who has directed all our primary campaigns and the organization in all of them, as he did in my campaign for the Senate in 1952. And of course, he has been the most essential figure.
At the White House, John made Bobby not only his attorney general, but also his most trusted advisor, even on matters of foreign or military affairs. He insisted, for example, on having him nearby during the whole Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962.
Traditionally, attorneys general have nothing to do with foreign policy. But after the Bay of Pigs, John Kennedy really wanted Bobby by his side, helping him to make the decisions on everything. Because there was only one person in the world that John Kennedy trusted unequivocally, and that was Robert Kennedy.
Robert and John's communion of spirit struck their collaborators.
No sooner did one of them begin a sentence than the other knew what he was saying. They understood each other so well that they talked in a kind of shorthand.
Yet, Robert was very different from John. He was a sincerely religious man, devoted to his family. He had got married at the age of 24, long before his elder brother. With his wife Ethel, also a devout Catholic, he fathered 11 children.
My mother and my father shared a belief that we are on earth for a short period of time, and that we are actually children of God. We prayed every night that John Kennedy would be the best president ever, and that my father would be the best attorney general ever.
What John most appreciated in Robert was his sense of justice and the integrity of his moral judgment. It is Robert, for example, who encouraged John to fully endorse the cause of the black civil rights movement.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated.
Was probably the first time in the history of our country that an American president would say that the question of civil rights, the question of race, was a moral issue. And he had the encouragement of Robert Kennedy to push him in this direction. Robert Kennedy was learning. He was growing. He said to me, John, I now understand. The young people have educated me. And you can see it. You can feel it. And Robert Kennedy, during that period, became so convinced, not just as a politician, not just as the Attorney General, but as a human being, that it was time for that to be some major steps to end racial discrimination in America.
Robert neither possessed John's charisma nor his ambition. After John's death, he felt that his brother's coat, which he had literally worn during his first month of mourning, was too big for him. When he finally decided to run for president in 1968, it was out of a sense of destiny to take up the torch of his brother's legacy. Robert knew that he was, in the eyes of millions of Americans, the legitimate heir to the murdered king, as well as his avenger. His public appearances led to displays of enthusiasm never seen before for a presidential candidate. And his total lack of concern for his own security only increased his prestige.
What sounded like shots turned out to be Chinese firecrackers. Bobby flinched, then went right on campaigning.
Given the exceptional bond between the Kennedy brothers and the unity between their presidential destinies, what are the odds that their assassinations were unrelated? Common sense suggests that they were killed by the same force and for the same motives, and that Robert was eliminated from the presidential race because he had to be prevented from reaching a position where he could reopen the case of his brother's death. Was there in 1968 any objective reason to believe that he intended to do that? That is the first question we must answer. Did Robert Kennedy plan to reopen the investigation on his brother's assassination? That question has been positively answered by David Talbot in his book Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, published in 2007 by Simon & Schuster. Talbot shows that Robert had never believed in the conclusion of the Warren Commission report that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin of his brother. His son, Robert Kennedy Jr., recently confirmed it. Knowing what to expect from Johnson, Robert had refused to testify before the Warren Commission, but he was compelled to write a statement saying that he knew of, quote, no credible evidence to support the allegations that the assassination of President Kennedy was caused by a domestic or foreign conspiracy, end of quote. To his close friends who asked him why he wouldn't voice his doubt publicly, he said, there is nothing I can do about it, not now. Robert was alienated and closely monitored by the new president, Lyndon Johnson, and his friend, FBI Director Edgar Hoover. Although still officially Attorney General, he knew he was powerless against the forces that had killed his brother. Yet, Robert lost no time to start his own investigation. A mere week after JFK's death, November 29, Bill Walton, a friend of the Kennedys, traveled to Moscow and passed to Nikita Khrushchev, via a trusted agent, a message from Robert and Jacqueline Kennedy. According to the memo found in the Soviet archives in the 1990s by Alexander Furusenko and Timothy Naftali, Robert and Jackie wanted to inform the Soviet leader that they believed John Kennedy had been, quote, the victim of a right-wing conspiracy, that only RFK could implement John Kennedy's vision, and that the cooling that might occur in US-Soviet relations because of Johnson would not last forever. At the same time, Robert started his own investigations. He first asked CIA Director John McCone, a Kennedy friend, to find out if rogue agents within the agency had anything to do with the plot. Then, in March 1964, suspecting a vengeance from organized crime, he contacted mobster Jimmy Hoffa, his sworn enemy, whom he had battled for 10 years, and whom he suspected of having taken revenge on his brother. A face-to-face encounter was organized between the two men on an airport runway, and Robert came out convinced of Hoffa's innocence. Robert also asked his friend Daniel Moynihan to search for any complicity in the Secret Service, responsible for the president's security. With the publication of the Warren Commission report, Robert had the confirmation that he could not expect anything from his government as long as Johnson was in power. He also knew that his own investigations were under surveillance. He contacted a former MI6 officer that he knew from the time his father had been ambassador in London. This British officer, in turn, contacted some trusted friends in France. With the tacit support of Charles de Gaulle, arrangements were made for two French intelligence operatives to conduct, over a three-year period, a quiet investigation that involved hundreds of interviews in the United States. Their report, replete with innuendo about Lyndon Johnson and right-wing Texas oil barons, was delivered to Bobby Kennedy only months before his own assassination in June of 1968. After Bobby's death, the last surviving brother, Senator Ted Kennedy, showed no interest in the material. The investigators then hired a French writer to edit the material into a book under the pen name of James Hepburn. The book was first published in French under the title L'Amérique brûle, then in English under the title Farewell America. Robert Kennedy had planned to run for the American presidency in 1972, but the escalation of the Vietnam War precipitated his decision to run in 1968.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
Another factor may have been the opening of the investigation by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison in 1967. Garrison was allowed to view Abraham Zapruder's 8mm film, confiscated by the FBI on the day of the assassination. This film, despite evident tampering, shows that the fatal shot came from the front of the president, and therefore not from the school book depository located behind him, where Oswald was supposed to be shooting from.
I looked at the wound again. I wanted to know and remember this the rest of my life. And the rest of my life, I will always know he was shot from the front.
The Warren Commission investigation concluded the shots came only from behind. Dr. Crenshaw says they're wrong.
The bullet struck about where and passed about where?
From here,
right through.
Although the official report suppressed their testimonies, many witnesses said that shots were fired from behind a fence on what is known as the grassy knoll, which was on the right front of the limousine at the moment of the shooting.
Pourtant, au cours de son enquête, la commission Warren a écarté toutes les preuves de coups de feu provenant du grassy knoll. Mais les témoignages sont là.
The shot came from behind the wooden fence. There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind.
Garrison would later claim that Robert gave him a discreet message of support through a common friend, letting him know that he was going to, quote, blow the whole thing wide open when he is president. Robert also confided to his friend William Atwood, then editor of Look magazine, that he, like Garrison, suspected a conspiracy, but that he couldn't do anything until he gets control of the White House. In conclusion, there can be little doubt that, had he been elected president, Robert Kennedy would have done everything possible to reopen the case of his brother's assassination, in one way or another. This certainly did not escape John's murderers. They had no other option but to stop him. This first conclusion is a sufficient reason to conduct a comparative analysis of both Kennedy assassinations in search of some converging clues that might lead us on the track of a common mastermind. Let us begin with Robert's assassination, and let us first focus on the very special profile of his alleged killer. Just hours after Robert's assassination, the press was able to inform the American people not only of the identity of the assassin, but also of his motive and even of his detailed biography. 24-year-old Siran Bishara Siran was born in Jordania and had moved to the United States when his family had been expelled from West Jerusalem in 1948. After the shooting, a newspaper clipping was found in Siran's pocket, quoting a favorable statement made by Robert Kennedy regarding the selling of military aircrafts to Israel. Handwritten notes by Siran found in a notebook at his home confirmed that his act had been premeditated and motivated by his hatred of Israel. That became the storyline of the mainstream media from day one. Jerry Cohen of the Los Angeles Times wrote a front-page article saying that Siran is, quote, "and a young man with a supreme hatred for the state of Israel." Cohen infers that Senator Kennedy became a personification of that hatred because of his recent pro-Israeli statements. Cohen further claimed to have learned from Los Angeles Mayor Samuel Yorty that about 3 weeks before shooting Robert Kennedy, Siran wrote a memo to himself saying, "Kennedy must be assassinated before June 5, 1968, that is, the first anniversary of the Six-Day War in which Israel humiliated three Arab neighbors, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. After September 11, 2001, Americans were reminded of Siran as a precursor of Islamic terrorism on the American soil, and his act was installed into the War on Terror mythology and propaganda. In a book entitled The Forgotten Terrorist, Mail Eitan, who specializes in debunking conspiracy theories, claims to present, quote, "a wealth of evidence about Siran's fanatical Palestinian nationalism and to demonstrate that Siran was the lone assassin whose politically motivated act was a forerunner of present-day terrorism," end of quote. In 2008, on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of Bobby's murder, the Jewish Daily Forward wrote, "Robert Kennedy was the first American victim of modern Arab terrorism." One cannot help but note the parallel between Kennedy's assassination and the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. In both tragic cases, Arab fanaticism reared its ugly head on American soil, irrevocably changing the course of events in this country. End of quote. Writing for the Boston Globe, Sasha Isenberg recalled that the death of Robert Kennedy was, quote, "a first taste of the political violence in the Middle East." He quotes Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz as saying it was perceived as an act of violence motivated by hatred of Israel and of anybody who supported Israel. It was in some ways the beginning of Islamic terrorism in America. It was the first shot. End of quote. The fact that Siran was from a Christian family was lost on Dershowitz. The Jewish Forward took care to mention it, only to add that Islamic fanaticism ran in his veins anyway. Quote, "But what he shared with his Muslim cousins, the perpetrators of September 11, was a visceral, irrational hatred of Israel." There is something suspicious in this insistence on making the assassination of Robert Kennedy a crime against Israel. But let us, for the moment, take these declarations seriously, and let us try to understand what kind of anti-Zionist Palestinian terrorist was Siran Siran. While studying his case more closely, perhaps we can learn something about the very nature of the Arab terrorism that has now become a familiar leitmotif of the mainstream narrative in our post-9/11 world. The first question is, did Siran really kill Robert Kennedy? Ballistic and forensic evidence show that, in fact, none of Siran's bullets hit Kennedy. According to the autopsy report of Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Thomas Noguchi, who confirms it in his memoirs, Robert Kennedy was hit by 3 bullets, while a 4th went through his coat. All these bullets were shot from behind Kennedy, 2 of them under his right armpit following an upward angle, and the 3rd, the fatal bullet, behind his right ear at point-blank range.
One gunshot wound was found behind the right ear, and there were abundance of a powder deposit on the edge of the right ear, and after test firing the similar weapon, we came to conclusion that the muzzle distance would be one inch from the right ear edge and no more than 3 inches.
Yet the sworn testimonies of 12 witnesses established that Robert had never turned his back on Ciaran and that Ciaran was 5 to 6 feet away from his target when he fired. Moreover, Ciaran was physically overpowered by Carl Hooker after his second shot. And although he continued pressing the trigger mechanically, his revolver was then not directed towards Kennedy. By tallying all the bullet impacts in the pantry and those that wounded 5 people around Kennedy, it can be established that at least 12 bullets were fired, while Ciaran's gun carried only 8. Finally, a computer analysis of audio recordings during the shooting, made by engineer Philippe Van Praag in 2008, confirms that 2 guns are heard.
13 shot sounds over a little bit over a 5-second interval of time. There are 2 shots, and then a pause of about 1 1/3 seconds, and then a flurry of succeeding shots. The primary point that people need to recall is that the capacity of Sirhan's gun was 8 shots. He did not have time to reload. And so anything more than 8 shots proves there had to be a second gun firing within that kitchen pantry, period.
We have strong evidence based upon this audio tape of 13 shots, 2 double shots, the make and the model of the gun, and the directionality of those shots into the back of Robert Kennedy.
All this evidence has been gathered by attorney William Pepper in a 58-page file submitted in 2011 to the Court of California with a request that Ciaran's case be reopened.
Bob was hit with 4 bullets were fired at him from the rear. From the rear now. 2 went through, 1 through the shoulder pad and 1 through the chest cavity that lodged in a ceiling tile that was actually behind Sirhan, where Sirhan was standing. So the shots from the senator were from behind, and the tracing of the bullets was slightly upward. So that's where the assassin was firing, and that's where he was standing behind the senator. And we have a view as to who that person was, but a good deal more probing and evidentiary work has to be done.
If Ciaran did not kill Robert Kennedy, then who did? The presence of a second shooter was indicated by several witnesses and reported on the same day by a few news outlets.
En ce qui concerne les agresseurs, ici à Paris, d'après les informations que nous transmettent les agences de presse, on dit qu'il y en aurait 2.
There are strong suspicions that the second shooter was Thane Eugene Caesar, a security guard hired for the evening by the Hotel Ambassador owned by Meyer Schein. Caesar was stuck behind Kennedy at the time of shooting. Several witnesses saw him draw his pistol, and one of them, Don Schulman, positively saw him fire.
As we were slowly pushed forward, another man stepped out, and he shot. Just then the guard, who was standing behind Kennedy, took out his gun, and he fired also. The next thing I knew is that Kennedy was shot 3 times.
Now, how far was Sirhan from Senator Kennedy at the time?
I would say approximately from 3 to 6 feet.
Where was this guard who was firing his gun?
He was standing directly to the side and back of Kennedy.
On what side?
He was standing on the right-hand side.
Contract killer could not find a more efficient and concealed position to do his deed. First, a clear opening to shoot at the heart, with little chance to be seen by witnesses situated either in front of or behind the victim. Then another opportunity for a concealed coup de grace in the back of the head as the victim slumps to the floor.
Incredibly, Caesar's weapon was never examined, and he was never interrogated, even though he did not conceal his hatred for the Kennedys.
He told police he had sold his .22 3 months before the assassination.
A receipt
proves that it was sold after the assassination. The person who made out this receipt confirmed Caesar told him at the time of the sale, be careful of this weapon, it was involved in a police shooting. He was the obvious first suspect. The police brushed him off and never investigated him further.
Even if we assume that Ciaran was the assassin of Robert Kennedy, another aspect of the case raises question. According to several witnesses, Ciaran seemed to be in a state of trance during the shooting and in a state of disorientation just after. More importantly, Ciaran has always claimed that he has never had any recollection of his act, even though, on the suggestion of his attorney, he admitted to have done it. For this, he was sentenced to death penalty. But the death penalty was abolished in California soon after, and his sentence was turned into life imprisonment. 50 years after the fact, Ciaran continues to claim,
however, I not only have never been able to remember what happened in that place at that time, but I have not been able to remember many things and incidents which took place in the weeks leading up to the shooting.
What do you remember about the shooting, if you're willing to talk about that?
I was there, but I don't remember the exact moment. I don't remember pulling my gun out of my body or whatever it was located, and I don't remember aiming it at any human being. I don't remember any of that.
Since 1968, several psychiatric analyses, including lie detector tests, have confirmed that Ciaran's amnesia is not faked. Therefore, experts in hypnosis and mental manipulation believe that Ciaran has been submitted to hypnotic programming.
It was obvious that he had been programmed to kill Robert Kennedy and programmed to forget that he'd been programmed.
This hypothesis is consistent with some repetitive lines written in a notebook found in Ciaran's room, which are reminiscent of automatic writing. In 2008, Harvard University professor Daniel Brown, a noted expert in hypnosis and trauma memory loss, interviewed Ciaran for a total of 60 hours. And concluded that Ciaran, who belongs to the category of high hypnotizables, acted involuntarily under the effect of hypnotic suggestion. His action of firing the gun was neither under his voluntary control nor done with conscious knowledge, but is likely a product of automatic hypnotic behavior and coercive control. End of quote. During his sessions with Dr. Brown, Ciaran could remember having been accompanied by an attractive woman before suddenly finding himself in a shooting range with a weapon he did not know. According to Brown's report, quote, Ciaran responded to a specific hypnotic cue given to him by that woman to enter range mode, during which Ciaran automatically and involuntarily responded with a flashback that he was shooting at a firing range at circle targets, end of quote. Month after Ciaran recalled these details, attorney William Pepper was able to prove that, just days before the assassination, Ciaran had visited a firing range accompanied by an unknown instructor and had signed the register. With the help of Professor Brown, Ciaran was also able to remember that his instructor had a falling mustache, which fits the description of famous hypnotist William Joseph Bryan Jr., whom other evidence also incriminates. Brian makes no secret of having worked for the Air Force in the brainwashing section. His biggest claim to fame was to have exposed, by hypnosis, the Boston Strangler, Albert DiSalvo, who thereafter confessed to the crime. Brian often bragged about it. This is significant because in the notebook found at Ciaran's home that Ciaran recognized to be in his own handwriting but that he cannot remember having written, we find this, God help me, please help me, Salvo, DiSalvo, DiSalvo. It is surmised that he heard the name while under hypnosis.
You have to have the person locked up physically, so you have control over them. You have to use a certain amount of physical torture involved. And there is also the use of long-term hypnotic suggestion, probably drugs, whatever, and so on. Under these situations where you have all this going for you, like the prison camp and so on, yes, you can brainwash a person to do just about anything. What I'm speaking about are the innumerable instances that we ran into when I was running the country's brainwashing and anti-brainwashing programs.
We know that in the 1960s, American military agencies were experimenting on mental control. Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, son of Hungarian Jews, directed the infamous CIA MKUltra project, which, among other things, was trying to answer questions like, can a person under hypnosis be forced to commit murder? According to a declassified document dated May 1951. We also know that Ciaran was attending meetings of occultist circles, practicing mental experiments, and this may have created opportunities to submit him to hypnotic programming. Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman has recently revealed that in May 1968, the month preceding Robert Kennedy's assassination, the Aman, the Israeli military intelligence, was planning to assassinate Yasser Arafat by hypnotically programming a Palestinian. The idea was proposed by a Navy psychologist named Binyamin Shalit, who claimed that, quote, if he was given a Palestinian prisoner, one of the thousands in Israeli jails, with the right characteristics, he could brainwash and hypnotize him into becoming a programmed killer. He would then be sent across the Jordan, join the Fatah there, and, when the opportunity arose, do away with Arafat. End of quote. The proposal was approved. Shalit selected a 28-year-old Palestinian from Bethlehem, whom he judged easily suggestionable. The operation failed, but it proved that in 1968, precisely, Israel was experimenting methods of assassination identical to the one used against Robert Kennedy. In the hypothesis that Ciaran has been manipulated, the question is, why him? Who had an interest in having people believe that Robert was killed by a fanatic Palestinian motivated by hatred of Israel? Israel, of course. But then we are faced with a dilemma. For why would Israel kill Robert Kennedy if Robert Kennedy was supportive of Israel? That would logically exclude Israel from the list of suspects. The dilemma rests on a misleading assumption, which is part of the deception. In reality, Robert Kennedy was not pro-Israel. He was simply in an electoral campaign. As everyone knows, a few good wishes and empty promises to Israel are an inescapable ritual in such circumstances. Robert's statements did not exceed the minimal requirements. It is claimed that Ciaran had in his pocket a newspaper clipping from the May 27 issue of Pasadena's Independent Star News, mentioning that Robert Kennedy had declared in an Oregon synagogue, quote, the United States should, without delay, sell Israel the 50 Phantom jets she has so long been promised, end of quote. But the author of this article, David Lawrence, underlined how little credit should be given to Robert's electoral promises. His article, entitled Paradoxical Bob, began like this. Presidential candidates are out to get votes, and some of them do not realize their own inconsistencies. All things considered, there is no ground for believing that Robert Kennedy would have been, as President of the United States, particularly friendly to Israel. The Kennedy family, proudly Irish and Catholic, was not known to be very appreciative of Jews. Joe Kennedy had been notoriously critical of Jewish influence during the Second World War. While ambassador in London from 1938 to 1940, he had supported the appeasement policy of British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain toward Hitler. When Roosevelt was about to enter the war, he had resigned and declared that he intended, quote, to devote my effort to what seems to me the greatest cause in the world today, to help the president keep the U.S. out of the war, end of quote. During John's presidential campaign, Menachem Begin's party, Erut, wondered publicly if the father, Joe Kennedy, quote, did not inject some poisonous drops of anti-Semitism in the mind of his children, end of quote. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book Profiles in Courage, published in 1956, Kennedy had declared his admiration for Senator Robert Taft, who, by calling the Nuremberg military trials of 1946 a shameful parody of justice, had sacrificed his political future. We will talk later about John Kennedy's tense relationship with the State of Israel. As for his brother, he had not been in his brother's government a particularly pro-Israel attorney general. He had infuriated Zionist leaders by supporting an investigation led by Senator William Fulbright of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations aimed at registering the American Zionist Council as a foreign agent, subject to the obligations defined by the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938, which would have considerably hindered its efficiency. After the assassination of John Kennedy, the American Zionist Council escaped this procedure, and its lobbying division, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, became the most powerful lobby in the United States and an indispensable instrument for the corruption and intimidation of American elected officials and for the control of American foreign policy. It was Nicholas Katzenbach, whom Johnson put at the head of the Department of Justice to replace Robert Kennedy, who buried the case against the American Zionist Council. Katzenbach is also known as having strongly recommended to the new president, Lyndon Johnson, a commission of inquiry to establish as soon as possible that Oswald was the only assassin of Kennedy. In conclusion, it is only by an outrageous hypocrisy that the Jewish Daily Forward could write on June 6, 2008, quote, "In remembering Bobby Kennedy, let us remember not just what he lived for, but also what he died for, namely the precious nature of the American-Israeli relationship," end of quote. Robert Kennedy's death had not been a bad thing for the American-Israeli relationship. As a U.S. president, would Robert have saved Israel from disaster in 1973, like Nixon and Kissinger, by providing her with unlimited military support against Egypt? It is unlikely. Rather, Robert Kennedy was a great loss for the Arab world, as had his brother John before him. Of course, the fact that the Zionist media lied when granting Robert Kennedy some kind of posthumous certificate of goodwill towards Israel, and thereby provided Israel with a kind of fake alibi, is not a sufficient reason for accusing Israel of having murdered Robert. Even the fact that the masterminds of the plot chose as their programmed instrument an anti-Zionist Palestinian, and thereby stirred a strong anti-Palestinian feeling among Americans at the same time as getting rid of Robert, does not prove that Israel was involved. What is lacking for a serious presumption is a plausible motive, and the motive of Robert's assassination, as we said before, must be found not in what Robert was declaring publicly during his campaign, but rather in what he confided only to his close friends, his intention to reopen the investigation on his brother's death. What would an unbiased investigation conducted under the supervision of Robert in the White House have revealed? This is what we must now determine. It is obvious for any person even vaguely informed that a genuine investigation would prove that Oswald was only the unwilling instrument of the plotters, a scapegoat prepared in advance to be blamed for the crime and then be slaughtered without a trial.
I'm just a patsy.
We will not here review the evidence which contradicts the official thesis of the Lone Gunner. They can be found in numerous other books and films. Just as notorious is the theory according to which the plot to kill Kennedy originated from the CIA, or rather from a secret network within the CIA in collusion with extremist elements in the Pentagon. That thesis looms the largest among conspiracy theories found in books, articles, and films that have been produced for 50 years since the Kennedy assassination. Rather than examining one by one all the arguments of this theory, we shall here trace back its origin. If the trail of the CIA is such a well-trodden path among Kennedy researchers, it is because it has been cut and marked by the mainstream media themselves, as well as by Hollywood. And that began even before the assassination, on October 2, 1963, with an article in the Washington Daily News picked up by the New York Times chief Washington correspondent Arthur Kroc. The article denounced the CIA's unrestrained thirst for power and quoted an unnamed, very high official who claimed that, quote, even the White House could not control it any longer, and that if the United States ever experiences an attempt at a coup to overthrow the government, it will come from the CIA and not from the Pentagon, end of quote. Without saying so, Kroc was letting his readers believe that the very high official whom he quoted was none other than the president himself, who was sending a message to the public via the press. In such a way, the New York Times was planting a sign a month and a half before the Dallas killing, pointing to the CIA as the most likely instigator of the upcoming coup. The sign said, "The president is going to fall victim of a coup, and this will come from the CIA." In the 1970s, the mainstream media and publishing houses again played a major role in steering conspiracy theorists toward the CIA trail while avoiding any hint of Israeli involvement. One major contributor to that effort was the Israeli-American Alan Weberman, a close associate to Jewish Defense Organization, with his 1975 book Coup d'État in America, The CIA and the Assassination of John F. Kennedy, co-authored by Michael Canfield. Weberman acknowledged Richard Perle's assistance in his investigation. His book contributed to the momentum that led the House Select Committee on Assassinations to reinvestigate in 1976 the murders of JFK and Dr. Martin Luther King, with a special focus on the CIA and organized crime. It is also in this context that Newsweek journalist Edward J. Epstein published an interview of George de Morenchild, a Russian geologist and consultant for Texan Oilman, who had befriended Oswald and his Russian wife in Dallas in 1962. De Morenchild admitted that Oswald was introduced to him at the instigation of a CIA agent. The problem is that de Morenchild was in no position to confirm or deny the words that Epstein ascribed to him. He was found dead a few hours after giving the interview. De Morenchild's death was ruled a suicide. The sheriff's report mentions that in his last month, he complained that, quote, the Jews and the Jewish mafia were out to get him. Needless to say, Epstein didn't mention anything about this. We should also mention author Mark Lane, Levin by his real name. He was the first to incriminate the FBI and the CIA directly in his articles and then in a 1966 book, Rush to Judgment, which received considerable media coverage. Lane was adamant that the CIA was a culprit in his last book, published in 2011, Last Word, My Indictment of the CIA in the Murder of JFK. That Israeli agents have been instrumental in spreading conspiracy theories targeting the CIA has become evident with Oliver Stone's film JFK, released in 1991, starring Kevin Costner in the role of District Attorney Jim Garrison. This film, which shook public opinion to the point of motivating the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992, was produced by Arnon Milchan. Described in a 2011 biography as being from his youth, quote, one of the most important covert agents that Israeli intelligence has ever fielded. Milchan was working in particular to boost Israel's nuclear program. In 2013, Milchan publicly revealed his extended activity as a secret agent of Israel. It is therefore no wonder that Stone's film gives no hint of the Mossad connection that Garrison had stumbled upon. All these examples demonstrate that the charges against the CIA have been the subject of considerable investment by authors who are predominantly Jewish and benefited from an effective echo chamber in the mainstream press. The mainstream news and entertainment industry engaged in double dealing. While ostensibly defending the official theory of the lone gunner on the front page, they channeled the skeptic scrutiny towards the CIA. This is a typical strategy of Israel, occupying the ground of protest and creating a rigged debate excluding any reference to Israel. The contradiction of the official thesis is maintained focus on the CIA, the military-industrial complex, or any other 100% American organization by an elite of militants whose primary motivation is the preservation of the interest of the Jewish community. In fact, the CIA conspiracy theory suffers from a crippling contradiction. According to it, the purpose of killing Kennedy was to create a pretext for invading Cuba, something that Kennedy had always refused to do. With Oswald groomed as a pro-Castro communist, the Dallas shooting was staged as a false flag attack to be blamed on Cuba, according to the CIA theory. But then, why did no invasion of Cuba follow Kennedy's assassination? It is because Johnson, we are told, thwarted the plot's ultimate aim to start World War III. This is to ignore the tremendous amount of evidence accumulated against Johnson. In fact, I believe the CIA thesis was originally pushed forward to counter the more natural and more popular thesis of a conspiracy headed by Johnson with Hoover's complicity. Another weakness in the CIA theory is the fact that researchers following this lead seem unable to come to any agreement about the mastermind of the plot. In fact, one of the names that come up most often is James Jesus Angleton, the head of counterintelligence within the CIA. Professor John Newman writes about him in Oswald and the CIA, quote, "No one else in the agency had the access, the authority, and the diabolically ingenious mind to manage this sophisticated plot." But, as a matter of fact, Angleton was also the Mossad liaison for the CIA as head of the CIA's Israel office, and he is widely recognized as having been an Israeli mole. One of his biographers, Tom Mangold, states, "Angleton's closest professional friends overseas came from the Mossad, and he was held in immense esteem by his Israeli colleagues and by the State of Israel, which was to award him profound honors after his death." Moreover, it has been revealed by reporter Joe Trento of the Sunday News Journal that it was Angleton himself who, in the 70s, played a key role in keeping the CIA under scrutiny by leaking to the press a secret memo he had written himself about the embarrassing presence of CIA agent Howard Hunt in Dallas on November 22, 1963. By a strange paradox, the authors who stand for the conventional thesis of a CIA conspiracy build their case on the biography of Oswald, while at the same time claiming that Oswald had almost nothing to do with the killing. It is about as useful as scrutinizing Osama bin Laden's biography to solve 9/11. If Oswald was just a patsy, as he claimed, the quest for the real culprits must logically begin by investigating the man who shot Oswald 2 days after his arrest in the Dallas police station, thus preventing a judgment that would have revealed the weakness of the accusation against Oswald. Oswald's assassin is known as Jack Ruby, but few people know that his real name was Jacob Leon Rubinstein, that he was the son of Jewish-Polish immigrants, and that, to the Warren Commission, he had explained his presence in the police station as a Yiddish translator for Israeli reporters. Originally from Chicago, Ruby was a member of the Jewish underworld, known as the Yiddish Connection. His mentor was Los Angeles gangster Mickey Cohen, whom he had known and admired since 1946. Cohen was the successor of the famed Benjamin Siegelbaum, known as Bugsy, one of the bosses of Murder Incorporated, the most brutal crime syndicate in the U.S. Mickey Cohen was in contact with Menachem Begin, the former Irgun chief, a specialist of false flag terrorism. Cohen was infatuated with the Zionist cause, as he explained in his memoir, quote, "Now I got so engrossed with Israel that I actually pushed aside a lot of my activities and done nothing but what was involved with this Irgun war," end of quote. We also know that Ruby phoned Al Gruber, a Mickey Cohen associate, just after Oswald's arrest. Most probably, that is when he received an offer that he couldn't refuse, for reasons possibly linked to his heavy debt. Ruby died from a rapidly spreading cancer in 1967, so he wouldn't have been around for a new trial under Robert Kennedy's presidency. Yet his Irgun connections and some of his recorded statements were highly disturbing. Ruby's defense lawyer William Kunstler wrote in his memoir that Ruby told him he had killed Oswald, quote, "for the Jews," and Ruby's rabbi Hillel Silverman received the same confession when visiting Ruby in jail. Ruby is only an intermediary link in a conspiracy that begins with the ambush of Dallas, extends to the cover-up of the Warren Commission, and involves a pact of silence with the directions of the major media. At every level of the conspiracy, we find the fingerprints of the Israeli deep state. Let's begin with the Dallas ambush. JFK's trip to Dallas had no official character and was sponsored by a powerful business group known as the Dallas Citizens Council. Kennedy was on his way to the reception organized in his honor when he was shot. The Dallas Citizens Council was a powerful group dominated by Jewish businessmen like the wealthy Julius Sheps, described by Brian Edward Stone in The Chosen Folks, Jews on the Frontiers of Texas, as, quote, "a member of every synagogue in the city and de facto leader of the Jewish community," end of quote. Abraham Zapruder, the man who filmed the assassination of John Kennedy and sold his film for $150,000 to Life magazine, was also a member of the Dallas Citizens Council. He was a clothing manufacturer whose headquarters happened to be located in the Dallas Textile Building, or Daltex, where one of the sniper's nests was located, according to JFK researchers who have studied the firing trajectories. Interviewed the same day on television, Zapruder could not hide his satisfaction. The host committee inviting Kennedy was chaired by another influential figure of the wealthy Jewish community in Dallas, advertising executive and PR man Sam Bloom. According to former British intelligence officer Colonel John Hugh Wilson, it was Bloom who, quote, suggested that the police make Oswald accessible to the press. He also suggested, against the explicit advice of the local FBI, that they move the alleged assassin from the Dallas police station to the Dallas County Jail in order to give the newsman a good story and pictures, end of quote. It was during this transfer that Oswald was shot by Ruby. Hugh Wilson also writes, when the police later searched Ruby's home, they found a slip of paper with Bloom's name, address, and telephone number on it. After the Dallas tragedy, Israel's Sayanim were also busy fabricating the official lie. Apart from the chairman, Earl Warren, chosen for his figurative role as Chief Justice, all key people in the investigative commission were either personal enemies of Kennedy, like Alan Dulles, the CIA director fired by Kennedy in 1961, or ardent Zionists, like Arlen Specter, who, at his death in 2012, was mourned by the Israeli government as, quote, an unswerving defender of the Jewish state, end of quote. Alan Specter was the inventor of what came to be called the magic bullet theory, a single bullet supposed to have caused 7 wounds to John Kennedy and John Connolly sitting before him in the limousine, and later found in pristine condition on a gurney in Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. In conclusion, at every step of the plot, we find a Zionist cabal, including businessmen, politicians, and gangsters, not forgetting media executives, all devoted to Israel. The most plausible motive for Israel to kill Kennedy has been revealed by 2 books in the 1990s, The Samson Option by Seymour Hersh, then Israel and the Bomb by Avner Cohen. And the lead has been followed up in 2007 by Michael Karpin in The Bomb in the Basement. What these investigators reveal is that John Kennedy, informed by the CIA in 1960 that Israel was developing its own nuclear weapons in the Dimona complex in the Negev desert, was firmly determined to force Israel to renounce it, and engaged in a showdown with David Ben-Gurion, who was both Israel's prime minister and defense minister. Ben-Gurion was convinced that by trying to prevent Israel from acquiring the bomb, Kennedy was endangering the very survival of the Jewish state to which he had devoted his entire life. Ben-Gurion wrote in one of his last letters to JFK, "Mr. President, my people has the right to exist, and this existence is in danger." Kennedy, however, remained unyielding. In a letter dated June 15, 1963, he demanded an immediate first visit, followed by regular visits every 6th month. Otherwise, he wrote, this government's commitment to and support of Israel could be seriously jeopardized. The result was unexpected. Ben-Gurion avoided receiving the letter by announcing his resignation on June 16. As soon as the new Prime Minister Levi Eshkol took office, Kennedy sent him a similar letter, dated June 5, 1963, but never got an answer. Did Ben-Gurion resign in order to deal with Kennedy from a deeper level? This is not implausible, because 11 days after resigning, Ben-Gurion was more committed than ever to provide Israel with the nuclear weapon. He said in a speech, "I do not know of any other nation whose neighbors declare that they wish to terminate it, and not only declare, but prepare for it by all means available to them. Our numbers are small, and there is no chance that we could compare ourselves with America's 180 million or with any Arab neighboring state. There is one thing, however, in which we are not inferior to any other people in the world. This is the Jewish brain, and the Jewish brain does not disappoint. Jewish science does not disappoint. I am confident that science is able to provide us with the weapons that will serve the peace and deter our enemies." End of quote. 5 months later, Kennedy's death relieved Israel of all pressure to stop its nuclear program and of all risk of publicity on this program. John McCone, the CIA director named by Kennedy to inform him about Israel's Dimona project, resigned in 1965, complaining about Johnson's complete lack of interest. According to historian Stephen Green, perhaps the most significant development of 1963 for the Israeli nuclear weapons program occurred on November 22. On a plane flying from Dallas to Washington, D.C., Lyndon Johnson was sworn in as the 36th President of the United States following the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson's White House saw no Dimona, heard no Dimona, and spoke no Dimona when the reactor went critical in early 1964. End of quote. Kennedy's determination to make Israel's Dimona project abort was only part of the Kennedy problem. Kennedy had committed himself to Arab heads of state to support UN Resolution 1994 for the right of return of the 800,000 Palestinian refugees expelled in 1947-48. For the last time on November 20, 1963, the United States delegation to the United Nations put this issue back on the agenda, causing a strong protest in Israeli circles. On top of that, since the first month of his presidency, Kennedy behaved very warmly toward Nasser, Israel's worst enemy. Historian Philip Muhlenbeck writes, "While the Eisenhower administration had sought to isolate Nasser and reduce his influence through building up Saudi Arabia's King Saud as a conservative rival to the Egyptian president, the Kennedy administration pursued the exact opposite strategy. After Kennedy's death, American foreign policy was reversed again, without the American public being aware of it. Johnson cut the economic aid to Egypt and increased the military aid to Israel, which, according to Stephen Green, reached $92 million in 1966, more than the total of all previous years combined. For 50 years, the Israeli trail in the Kennedy assassination has been smothered, and anyone who dares mention it is immediately ostracized. American Congressman Paul Findlay nevertheless wrote in March 1992 in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, "It is interesting to note that in all the words written and uttered about the Kennedy assassination, Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad, has never been mentioned." End of quote. One single author has seriously investigated that trail, Michael Collins Piper, in his 1995 book Final Judgment, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination Conspiracy. Piper was largely ignored by the mainstream of the Kennedy Truth Movement, but his work has made a strong impact. In 2013, in his foreword to a collection of letters by Kennedy, including those addressed to Ben-Gurion about Dimona, Martin Sandler writes about Piper's work, "Of all the conspiracy theories, it remains one of the most intriguing." End of quote. It is, in fact, a theory widespread in Arab countries. Libyan leader Muhammad Gaddafi believed it.
Kennedy الذي قرر أن يفتش مفاعل ديمونة وأصر على تفتيش ليتأكد من أنه يصنع أسلحة ذرية وإلا لا ورفض الإسرائيليون وأخيرا أصر هو على التفتيش كان المخرج من هذه الأزمة هو استقالة بن-غوريون استقال حتى لا يوافق على تفتيش مفاعل ديمونة وأعطى الضوء الأخضر بقتل كينيدي وهكذا قتل كينيدي بسبب مفاعل ديمونة وإصراره على تفتيشه بسبب إصراره على تفتيشه قتل كينيدي.
On September 23, 2009, Gaddafi had the guts to demand a new investigation in front of the General Assembly of the United Nations.
قضيته تطرح في الجمعية العامة لابد أن نطق صراحة.
Several investigators have identified Lyndon Johnson as the mastermind of the Kennedy assassination. It is beyond doubt that the plotters acted with the foreknowledge that Johnson, who immediately stepped in as head of state after Kennedy's death, would cover them. The context of national crisis enabled Johnson to bully both justice and the press while achieving his life's ambition. Johnson not just benefited from the plot, he participated in its elaboration. As a former senator from Texas, he could mobilize high-ranked accomplices in Dallas to prepare the ambush. Johnson also exerted a tight control on the Navy, where he had obtained the privilege to name his Texan partners as Navy Secretary, first John Connally in 1961, then Fred Korth 1 year later. Johnson's connection to the Navy is an important aspect of the case, because it is under the control of Navy officers that Kennedy's counterfeit autopsy was performed in Washington after his body had been literally robbed at gunpoint from Parkland Hospital in Dallas. The autopsy report from the Navy Hospital stated that the fatal bullet had entered the back of Kennedy's skull, in contradiction to the unanimous testimonies of the Dallas Hospital staff. Contrary to a widespread but erroneous belief, Lee Harvey Oswald had been recruited not by the CIA but by the Navy. He was a Marine, and as a Marine he had worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI. Johnson had actually taken advantage of his connections in the Navy to participate in the greatest corruption ever recorded at that time. His accomplice, Fred Korth, was forced to resign as Navy Secretary in November 1963, only weeks before the Dallas coup, after the Justice Department, headed by Robert Kennedy, had implicated him in a fraud involving a $7 billion contract for the construction of 1,700 TFX military aircraft by General Dynamics, a Texas company. Johnson's personal secretary, Bobby Baker, was charged in the same case, and the scandal was about to blow up on Johnson's face. Because of this mounting scandal and other suspicions of corruption, Kennedy was determined to change vice president for his upcoming re-election campaign. While in Dallas the day before the president's visit, Richard Nixon's publicized the rumor of Johnson's removal, as the Dallas Morning News reported on the morning of November 22. Instead, Johnson became president that very day. Many Americans immediately suspected Johnson's involvement in the Dallas coup, and all the more after the publication in 1964 of a book by James Evetts Haley, A Texan Look at Lyndon, which portrayed Johnson as a man of unlimited ambition and corruption. According to his biographer Robert Carroll, Johnson had, quote, a hunger for power so fierce and consuming that no consideration of morality or ethics, no cost to himself or to anyone else, could stand before it. Robert Kennedy himself suspected Johnson, whom he had always despised and mistrusted. He is reported as saying, "Johnson lies all the time. I'm just telling you, he just lies continuously about everything. In every conversation I have with him, he lies. As I've said, he lies even when he doesn't have to." End of quote. Through the years, a great amount of evidence and testimonies have been gathered against Johnson in the killing of John Kennedy. The evidence incriminating Johnson does not conflict with the evidence against Israel. Both trails converge in the person of Jack Ruby. The hypothesis that Ruby acted with knowledge of Johnson's involvement is a likely explanation for some of his odd statements to the Warren Commission. He insisted on being brought to Washington to speak directly to Johnson and added, "There will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me so my people don't suffer because of what I have done." End of quote. He said that he feared that his act would be used, quote, "to create some falsehood about some of the Jewish faith," end of quote, but added that, quote, "maybe something can be saved if our president, Lyndon Johnson, knew the truth from me," end of quote. Ruby seemed to have attempted to send a message to Johnson through the commission, or rather a warning that he might spill the beans about Israel's implication if Johnson did not intervene in his favor. We get the impression that Ruby expected Johnson to get him out of prison, just as in 1952 Johnson had managed to avoid prison for his killer Malcolm Wallace, although found guilty of first-degree murder on Johnson's sister's lover who had tried to blackmail Johnson. Yet Johnson did nothing to get Ruby out of jail, and Ruby was sentenced for life. Ruby's sense of betrayal explains why in 1965, after giving a brief press conference, Ruby implicitly accused Johnson of Kennedy's murder.
"I want to correct what I stated before. He was vice president. Remember I said that? He was vice president? Yes, I did when I mentioned about Adlai Stevens. If he was vice president, there would never have been an assassination of our beloved President Kennedy.
Did you explain it, Grant?
Well, the answer is the man in office now."
Ruby's full statement to the Warren Commission was leaked to journalist Dorothy Kilcullen and published in the New York Journal American in August 1964. Kilcullen also interviewed Jack Ruby and boasted afterwards of being about to break the real story and publish the biggest scoop in the century. But Kilcullen was found dead by an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol on November 8, 1965. As for Ruby, he was put into solitary confinement and he died in 1967, officially from a rapidly spreading cancer. Jack Ruby is not the only element connecting Johnson to Israel. Far from it. In truth, Johnson had always been Israel's man. His electoral campaigns had been funded since 1948 by Zionist financier Abraham Feinberg, president of the fundraising organization Americans for Haggadah Incorporated, and a key financier in the Dimona Project. It is the same Abraham Feinberg who, after the Democratic primaries in 1960, made the following proposal to Kennedy, as Kennedy himself reported to his friend Charles Bartlett. "We know your campaign is in trouble. We're willing to pay your bills if you let us have control of your Middle East policy." It was also two strong supporters of Israel, Washington Post publisher Philip Graham and his main columnist Joseph Alsop, who finally convinced Kennedy to take Johnson as his running mate. Most probably, they blackmailed Kennedy with proofs of his adulterous adventures, of which Edgar Hoover, a close friend of Johnson, was well informed. According to Evelyn Lincoln, Kennedy's personal secretary for 12 years, quote, "Jack knew that Hoover and LBJ would just fill the air with womanizing," end of quote. Whatever the real nature of the blackmail, Kennedy once apologized to his assistant Hyman Raskin, saying, "You know, we had never considered Lyndon, but I was left with no choice. Those bastards were trying to frame me. They threatened me with problems, and I don't need more problems." And so it is that John was forced to choose Johnson as vice president by the Zionist network, despite the fierce opposition of his brother Robert. In 2013, Associated Press reported about newly released tapes from Johnson's White House office showing LBJ's personal and often emotional connection to Israel. An article from the Five Towns Jewish Times, running under the title "Our First Jewish President, Lyndon Johnson," elaborates on that end, and after recalling Johnson's continuous support of Jews and Israel in the 40s and 50s, then his role in the crafting of the pro-Israel UN Resolution 242 in November 67, concludes, "President Johnson firmly pointed American policy in a pro-Israel direction. In a historical context, the American emergency airlift to Israel in 1973, the constant diplomatic support, the economic and military assistance, and the strategic bonds between the two countries can all be credited to the seeds planted by LBJ." End of quote. The article also mentions that research into Johnson's personal history indicates that he inherited his concern for the Jewish people from his family. His aunt, Jessie Johnson Hatcher, a major influence on LBJ, was a member of the Zionist Organization of America. In an additional note, the article said, "The facts indicate that both of Lyndon Johnson's great-grandparents on the maternal side were Jewish. The line of Jewish mothers can be traced back three generations in Lyndon Johnson's family tree. There is little doubt that he was Jewish." End of quote. The Jewish and the Israeli press occasionally refer to Johnson's secret Jewishness and often remember with gratitude his Israel-friendly policy. Whatever was the reason of Johnson's loyalty to Israel, it is a fact that, thanks to Johnson, Israel could acquire its first atomic bomb somewhere between 1965 and 67, and carry out its plan to annex Palestinian territories beyond the boundaries of the United Nations partition plan. By leaning on the Pentagon and CIA oaks, who had previously been bridled by Kennedy, Johnson intensified the Cold War and created the climate of tension which Israel needed in order to demonize Egyptian President Nasser and reinforce Israel's own stature as an indispensable U.S. ally in the Middle East. During the Six-Day War of 1967, Israel managed to triple its territory while creating the illusion of acting in legitimate defense to the applause of the American press. The lie could not deceive American intelligence agencies, but Johnson had given the green light to Israel's attack and even authorized James Angleton of the CIA to give Israel the precise positions of the Egyptian air bases, which enabled Israel to destroy them in just a few hours. 4 days after the start of the Israeli attack, Nasser accepted the ceasefire request from the UN Security Council. It was too early for Israel, who had not yet achieved all her objectives in terms of conquest. That is when, on June 8, Israel attacked the USS Liberty, an unarmed NSA spy ship stationed in international waters off Sinai.
They drop napalm and strafe its decks with rockets, cannon fire, and armor-piercing rounds before trying to sink it with torpedoes.
We had no way to defend ourselves, and it was just, we were just slaughtered.
The ship was bombed, strafed, and torpedoed during 75 minutes by Israeli Mirage jets and three torpedo boats, while Johnson from the White House intervened to prohibit the nearby Sixth Fleet from rescuing it. Even the lifeboats were machine-gunned. The attack would have been blamed on Egypt if it had succeeded, that is, if the ship had sunk and its crew had been exterminated. The operation would then have given Johnson a pretext for intervening on the side of Israel against Egypt. But it failed. The USS Liberty affair was suppressed by a commission of inquiry headed by Admiral John Sidlem McCain II, father of John McCain III, who recently supported ISIS terrorists against Syria.
Everyone in the national security team recommended arming ISIS.
Johnson accepted Israel's spurious targeting error explanation. What's more, Johnson rewarded Israel by lifting the embargo on offensive military equipment. U.S.-made tanks and aircraft immediately flowed to Tel Aviv. This failed false flag attack is evidence of Johnson's secret complicity with Israel, implying high treason against his own country.
Many of Johnson's closest friends and advisors were pro-Israeli, and they reported back to Tel Aviv on his every move. The Israeli story constantly shifted to counter whatever new intelligence the White House received. So sensitive were these communications that the Israelis used code names to protect the identity of their White House agents. But for the first time, the members of the ring can be named. Hamlet was a million-dollar fundraiser for the Democrats. When he rang, Johnson took his calls. He was Abe Feinberg. Menashe was Arthur Goldberg, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Harari was David Ginsburg, a high-profile Washington lawyer who also represented the Israeli embassy. Ilan was Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas. Lyndon Johnson had dinner with him on the eve of the Six-Day War. The strategy worked. The U.S.-Israeli relationship proved to be stronger than the killing and injuring of more than 200 Americans.
In conclusion, besides the fact that John and Robert were brothers, their assassinations have at least two things in common, Johnson and Israel. First, their deaths are precisely framed by Johnson's presidency, which was also marked by other political assassinations, such as Martin Luther King's. Johnson was in control of the two investigations on John and Robert's murders. Secondly, in both cases, the central element that contradicts the official story strongly suggests the implication of the Israeli deep state. In the case of Robert, it is the choice of the manipulated Patsy, which was obviously meant to disguise Robert's assassination as an act of hatred against Israel. In the case of John, it is the identity of the man tasked with killing the Patsy, a Jewish gangster linked to the Irgun. These two common elements in the Kennedy assassinations, Johnson and Israel, are themselves closely linked because Johnson was a man acting for Israel, just like Ruby, although at a higher level. The evidence for Johnson's secret loyalty to Israel includes his high treason in the USS Liberty affair. The causal link between the two assassinations then becomes clear. Even if Robert had been pro-Israel, which he was not, Israel and Johnson would have had a compelling reason to eliminate him before he got to the White House and reopened the investigation on his brother's death. In order to solve the mystery of John Kennedy's assassination, we simply have to look into the two other assassinations that are connected to it. On the one hand, the assassination of Oswald, the man whose trial could have exposed the real plotters, and on the other hand, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the man who would have reopened the case if he had reached the White House. And both of these assassinations bear the signature of the Israeli deep state. The Kennedy assassinations are obsessing the American psyche and corrupting its character. The sense of a terrible truth hidden by the government is making America deeply neurotic, like a repressed family secret affecting the whole personality. This lie buried into the deep state has rendered Americans vulnerable to other lies, just like any lie creates a predisposition for new lies and even the need for more lies to cover it up. Having fallen deeper and deeper under the control of Israel, America is now morally corrupt and haunted by its own lies. Conversely, exposing one lie will make other lies fall one by one. That explains why there is still today, more than 50 years later, a determination from the corrupt American Zionist-controlled leadership to keep the truth hidden. This is also why unveiling the truth about the Kennedy assassinations is so crucial and will lead inevitably to unveiling the truth about 9/11 and to a new awareness about the other lies by which the United States and the world have been drawn into wars against the enemies of Israel. Carl Jung, the psychologist of the collective unconscious, said that the mythical character of a life expresses that it has a historical significance. The life and death of the Kennedys have such a mythical dimension. The Kennedy dynasty embodied the Irish Catholic root and branches of the American people, with all that it represents in terms of antagonism to English Puritanism, the most Judaized branch of Christianity. This antagonism goes back to the martyr of Ireland under British oppression. During the Second World War, the Republic of Ireland remained neutral, refusing to ally itself to the British. Joseph Kennedy was then a leading figure of the isolationist. Like Charles Lindbergh, he believed that wealthy Jews were pushing the Roosevelt administration into total war against Germany. After the war, an increase in Jewish cultural influence and a decline of the Irish Catholic voice could be observed. In that context, the presidency of John Kennedy was, in the collective psyche and the destiny of the United States, of great spiritual significance. This meta-historical significance of the Kennedys did not escape the Zionist Jews, inhabited by the supremacist geopolitical project of their ancient scriptures, and placing all their hopes in their ability to influence U.S. foreign policy in favor of Israel. There is, in the Kennedy tragedy, a providential meaning. This is why the light on this affair will mark the beginning of the end of the mental control exercised by the Zionist movement on America and the West in general. One day, hopefully, the Kennedy brothers will receive in the United States the national recognition they deserve as heroes and martyrs in the fight against Israel's global crime. President Kennedy's son, John Kennedy Jr., embodied the Kennedy myth in the heart of all Americans. The route seemed traced for him to become president one day. He died on July 16, 1999, with his pregnant wife and his sister-in-law, when his private plane suddenly and mysteriously nosedived into the ocean a few seconds after he had announced his approach on Martha's Vineyard Airport. John Jr. was literally born with the Kennedy presidency. From the minute he came into this world, he had been in the national spotlight. As Americans watched him grow up in the White House, they developed a strong affection for him. The iconic image of little John John saluting his father's coffin on the day of his third birthday encapsulated a nation's grief and impressed on millions of Americans the dream of seeing him reclaim the Oval Office one day. For in the American collective psyche, the Kennedys represented royalty and JFK Jr. was the legitimate heir to the throne. In 1995, John launched his political magazine, George. Under the appearance of superficiality, it engaged in controversial issues of deep politics that reflected John's interest for conspiracy issues. For example, in December 1996, George was the only mainstream magazine exploring the inconsistencies of the official report on the explosion of Flight TWA-800 soon after leaving JFK International on July 17, 1996. The National Transportation Safety Board claimed it was an accident, although 375 witnesses saw one or two bright flare objects hit the plane, many of them believing it was a missile. Israeli intelligence had actually tried to put the blame on an Iranian missile, but some investigators believed this was in fact a failed Israeli false flag attack designed to force the United States into retaliating against Iran. In March 1997, George published an article by the mother of Yigal Amir, the man convicted of assassinating Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, claiming that her son had been manipulated by Israeli deep state operatives. In October 1998, John Kennedy Jr. released a special conspiracy issue of George magazine, which included an article by film director Oliver Stone. According to testimonies from his friends, John Jr. was haunted by the death of his father and quite knowledgeable about independent investigations about it. At age 39, John was preparing his entry into politics, and he was about to announce it publicly. He had also expressed to his friend his ambition to ultimately reach for the presidency. While trying to shield him from celebrity, his mother Jackie had raised him in the worship of his father and in the idea of his own presidential destiny. According to his biographers, in 1999, John had made up his mind to launch his political career. Given his personality and his immense popularity, he had high chances to make it to the presidency in less than 20 years. John Jr. would have started his political career in New York, the city he loved and that loved him. According to some of his friends, he would have aimed at the seat of governor in 2003. According to others, he had decided to run for the New York Senate seat in 2000. This is the seat that his uncle Bobby had occupied from 1964 to 1968 and that Daniel Moynihan, a former assistant to President Kennedy, was going to leave vacant in 2000. John's chances were great. According to his biographer Christopher Anderson, John's plan interfered with Hillary Clinton's. The Clintons, who were to leave the White House in January 2001, had just purchased a home in New York State, and Hillary was gearing up to run for the Senate as a stepping stone to her own presidential future. Hillary had never resided in New York State before, and her chances to beat John Jr. were very weak. John's death allowed her to win the seat. Has the American Zionist criminal deep state perceived the danger that John Jr. represented from the moment he started his political career? Many elements suggest that his death had not been an accident. Several witnesses testified having heard or seen his plane explode. Its sudden and steep fall cannot be explained as a pilot's error, as claimed by the official report. On the order of President Clinton, the rescue and recovery missions were conducted under national security conditions by the Navy, and the investigation was supervised by the same people in the National Transportation Safety Board who had falsified the investigation on TWA-800. Once the bodies were recovered, no autopsy was conducted. They were cremated and their ashes scattered at sea in a Navy ceremony, although this was not in the tradition of either families. John would certainly have wished to be buried beside his father and mother.
Apologies, we've had to cancel tonight's live feed due to family reasons.
We had three prime ministers, a deputy prime minister from Canada. We had, I think altogether something like 15 key EU, not just EU, obviously European, including the Brits, politicians, including these European commissioners, the appointees, who effectively are the government of Europe, sitting down with the European deep state and, most importantly, the American military.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just gobsmacking. And they again, Zander, the press secretary, Bilderberg, or the spokesperson, again stressed these people, including Stoltenberg, are all just there as private individuals. You know, just forget the office. They're just there as private individuals. And we know they're not there as private individuals. For example, I spoke to Tom Tugendhat, Minister of State for security for the UK, and he said he told me he would be reporting, you know, back the contents of these conversations, these discussions, to the relevant officials. So it is, he's on official business, but they're so disingenuous. They say that it's just a private confab. We're just a load of blokes sitting down, and a few women obviously, and sitting down and having a chat. But no, I don't know about you, Tony, if you look at the list, it's such a powerful lineup this year.
Difficult to be kind of turn up for a relaxed chit-chat when there's all these heavy things. I mean, obviously, there's all the economic stuff as well in the background. But look, it's got very much, it seems very much for all through the years to be absolutely keyed into the NATO states. And there's also this Finland has just joined NATO. NATO seems to be becoming almost more powerful than the politicians in the, you know, we elect in the countries that are part of NATO. And Sweden's joining soon too, apparently.
Yeah, so it's almost like a preamble or kind of pre-meeting to the NATO summit that's coming up in Lithuania, the Vilnius summit, where they expect to, you know, announce the joining of these countries and cement it all, particularly Ukraine. And, of course, the Ukraine Minister for Foreign Affairs, Kubala, was there as well. So I'm sure all of this stuff, as you say, it's going to trickle down in the next couple of months, was all kind of, you know, rubber-stamped and chatted through. Maybe not in the kind of the actual conference room itself, but in a lot of the satellite meetings that we're sure were taking place. For example, Oskar Stenström, the negotiator for Sweden joining NATO, was present in the hotel, the Pastrana Palace Hotel, and got his picture there with Magdalena Andersson, the ex PM of Sweden. So, all right, he wasn't on the list. He probably didn't attend the sessions in the kind of the locked conference.
We don't know, do we?
We don't know, but I think they're a bit OCD about that. They don't have a big room either. There's not room for lots of different people. But he was there, and he was with the ex-PM of Sweden, and he, you know, who he was working with in office, in government. And now he's the key negotiator for Sweden's entering into NATO. So, yeah, it's all happening. And
what that does tell us, I think, is every time we find out about somebody who's not on the list, who we get photographs of, who's there, this, I think, to me, tells us the things that they're most sensitive about. They don't want people to know that he's there, because actually this is, as you say, a pre-meeting for next month's NATO summit, which is going to be very important. They just don't want even the international press to be suspicious about him being there. But we know he is there, and so that's why it's so important to be there.
Yeah.
This meeting that's coming up in Latvia, in Riga, I think, is in July. They're trying to get the Ukraine to join NATO, never mind Sweden, which could, you know, basically that's World War III. You know, so there's
very, very provocative.
About all of this. So are there any other, I mean, Kissinger's just turned 100. He was there, amazingly. He managed to make it too.
He managed to make it. And I think his iron will wouldn't have it any other way. He did his long haul flight on his private jet with Eric Schmidt. He was on the jet too, at least on the way back. We saw him at the Keshgos private airport, and they shared a jet back. I mean, they are very, very close. Schmidt and Kissinger just recently co-authored a book on AI. Kissinger's so up to date, or even at his age. But he wasn't looking in good shape. He is 100. He had to be sort of hauled up the kind of deck or whatever it is to his jet. And he didn't. It was a big deal. It did take quite a long time. But I think I'm not sure if he'll make another one in Europe. He certainly was there last year in DC. But yeah, he's still going, and it really looks the relationship he has with Schmidt. It really looks as if he's handing over, you know, the baton to Schmidt ideologically, and that Schmidt will be the new, you know, Kissinger. He's carrying this whole ideology on, because Schmidt has gone very much back into got into defence now, hasn't he? And mainly worked for the Pentagon.
I wonder if you've got any. If you've managed to glean anything from going through the photos about, you know, who's chatting with him. I mean, this is one of the things I find so fascinating about looking at the pictures from the Bilderberg up. So, you know, this is what most people have to do. We are actually, we spend a bit of time actually there so we can see people chatting with each other. But sometimes you can see, like, here is, you know, say, I don't know, the number one military mind of NATO sitting down with somebody who's designing AI, you know. Now this sort of thing sends all the signals about what's going on in there.
Yeah, they all, and also just they're kind of cozy relationships, and it's not. For example, going back home on these private jets, you would see Wolfgang Schmidt, a German minister, sharing a lift with Matthias Doppner of Axel Springer, Bilderberg Steering Committee member. And so, you know, they're locked in together, this policymaker and this CEO, Bilderberg Steering Committee member. You know, I have to say, Wolfgang Schmidt looked delighted to be getting onto that jet, really thought he'd hit the big time there.
Yeah,
and he would be schmoozed, you know, no oversight. This was also a meeting, or was it social, or were they just private individuals?
Yeah, well,
they love that grey area.
Yeah. Sorry, I just come across as a bit of a, you know, it's kind of a clique, isn't it? It's an extended
very clique. Very cozy, yeah. And these politicians all want to be part of the clique because they know that's where the money is going to be, that they'll get these lucrative, you know, these lucrative jobs when they leave office, and they want to be in the in club. They want to be Bilderberg regulars. So going, the Brits went home. We had Jeremy Fleming, ex-GCHQ, John Sawyers, ex-MI6, on the Prudential with Jet, we think, or maybe it was just the charter, but it was Shriti Vadera, head of Prudential. She was in there, and Baroness Moyo. They all went off together on a jet. So, you know, it's all very cosy, the corporations and, you know, politicians and the deep state. And, you know,
obviously David Lammy is quite an important one because he's likely to be our next foreign secretary.
He's been twice now, I think, or was it three times? Yeah. I think it looked like he kept walking in and out of the hotel, an unusually frequent kind of number of times, you know, he was like in and out, in and out. And I think it might be that he wasn't staying there because he's got to declare it as a gift, and there were some questions last time. So, yeah, but he loved it. He was very contemptuous, actually, to us outside.
Well, I think that mindset of the politician that's being groomed rather than elected is a contemptuous mindset of the whole of humanity, and he's not the only one.
Yeah, he's really going for it, and I think he's hoping he'll be one of the in crowd. Tom Tugendhat did talk. He was going for a walk with Matthias Doppner, Axel Springer, and John Micklethwaite from the Bloomberg, and Danny Minton-Bedos from the Economist group. He did talk, and yes, he did say he was going to report back to relevant officials, and that he paid for his own travel expenses. So we'll see. We can find out later.
Right, but I'm sure
he was completely unapologetic.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. to know. Don't you mind about the future. Don't you try to think ahead. Save tomorrow for tomorrow. Think about today instead.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz?
I could give you facts and figures.
What's the buzz?
Even give you plans and forecasts. Even tell you where I'm going.
When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem? When do we ride to Jerusalem?
Why should you want to know? Why are you obsessed with fighting times and fates you can't defy? If you knew the path we're riding, you'd understand it less
what's
than
buzz?
I.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this bit. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try. Let me try to cool down this. Let me try to cool down this bit.
That is good while you prattle through your supper. Where and when and who and how. She alone has tried to give me what I need right here now.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Apologies, we've had to cancel tonight's live feed due to family reasons.
You all had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend as we come to you Monday night, six nights a week here, of course, 3 hours a night, coast to coast and around the world, live on the internet and all over North America via home satellite receiver. Jim Keith made quite a name for himself a couple of years ago, especially with his most recent book dealing with the black helicopter issue, Black Helicopters Over America. That has now been graced with a sequel, which we're going to talk to Jim about next week. But his most current title, as I just mentioned, is entitled Mind Control, World Control. And I can think of few authors I'd like to see tackle this subject other than Jim Keith, who has a certain flair for looking at things in a unique way and doing some great research. Jim, are you there?
Hi there, Jeff.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good. We have much to talk about. Most people listening right now would probably say that we're dealing with an issue of what you'd call soft mind control vis-a-vis the shooting incidents which continue to seemingly proliferate coast to coast in this country. I just got a report of a five-year-old in kindergarten in Memphis, Tennessee, who was disarmed by his teacher with a .25 caliber pistol the kid had, and the kid said he was going to shoot the teacher because he had to do a timeout. Now, this is not the hardcore essence of your book and your research, but it is a very important thing to discuss because mind control, of course, is an A to Z topic anymore.
Yeah, I'm almost taken aback by commenting on the idea of a five-year-old wielding a pistol and trying to take out his teacher. It's almost it's almost too much really to grasp that our world has been, I believe, shaped in such a violent fashion.
Agreed, 100%, Jim. It is something that just doesn't compute. I mean, how a young mind, can be so influenced and be given a template that
violence is the answer, but I really, without getting on the soapbox here, we've talked about this many times on the program. The average young person in this country watches television 43 hours a week, folks. And when you watch TV, we've established on this program, as have many other scientists, that you lapse into a deep theta state where you really no longer have the ability to discern and differentiate and make moral judgments about what's going in. It just pours in. And again, our young people are seeing 8,000 murders and over 200,000 injuries, violent injuries, by the time they are 16 through our major video media, whether it be film or television. These people are learning things. They're being programmed. They don't understand pain. They see violence. It's one-dimensional, two-dimensional at best. We have mind control, Jim, in virtually all facets of this society.
Right. Well, you know, what I focus on in my new book is not so much what I term the soft mind control of public relations and the influence of the TV, yeah. But I'm really delving more into the long-term technological mind control, including implants, including the activities of the CIA. The other is very pervasive, but you know, I think that I think there's a hidden history of mind control that is even more gruesome, that the wraps are very rarely taken off of.
Exactly right, and that's what your book does such a great job at revealing and assaying. What we need to do, I think, is go back if we can, and I'd like to start with the name Delgado, which is not a name that is exactly a household word to people, but Mr. Delgado did work that keyed an awful lot of money, and that means your money and my money, to be spent on some of these dark areas of mind control. Tell us about Delgado's work.
Yeah, really what we're looking at with Dr. Jose Delgado, he's almost a touchstone for this kind of electronic / technological mind control. He worked... what we know of his researches took place primarily in the 1950s. He was the inventor of a rather science fictional device called the Stimoceiver. And what that is an electronic control device for human beings that was injected through a hole in the skull. And using this tiny control device, Delgado could electronically order people from a distance, turn on emotions, turn on feelings, drive them berserk, walk them around, this sort of thing. And it is very, very little touched upon in the mainstream media that this sort of technology even exists. But Delgado had it rather fine-tuned as early as the 1950s.
Well, what you said was very interesting. You said what we know of his work, and quite clearly this man would probably fall into the same basket as Nikola Tesla. We don't know everything Tesla did. We probably don't know everything Delgado did. If 40 years ago he was implanting devices, which would give him, by and large, near-total control over living, breathing beings, and we all, I think, those of us who study this, know of his work. There was a story about a bull. Remember that one?
Yeah, I do.
That's very interesting. Go ahead and tell us about that if you remember enough.
Yeah, actually Delgado is Spanish and was connected in his early days with Spanish fascist movements and so forth. But one of his most famous experiments was wiring the brain of a bull and then going out into the bull ring.
Yeah.
With impunity and feeling completely safe, because every time the bull charged him, he would simply press a button and the bull would be brought to a standstill.
It's incredible. I mean, just to see a demonstration like this, imagine what the defense community and the military thought when they first realized that this technology was in fact real and applicable. This is 40 years ago.
Yeah, and Delgado, that's the most... the most famous of his experiments, but there were some truly more startling experiments that he engaged in. For instance, he kept a colony of some primate, I forget what it was, a baboon or something, in the Bahamas, a compound baboons that were wired, and he worked on social experimentation, getting otherwise timid baboons to take over and revolt against the leaders of the baboon right. society. And his comments went something to the effect of that humans too were equally controllable, and that society in fact should be totally controlled from above like that.
In your book, you have gone through many dark and rather tawdry areas of mind control endeavor. Tavistock, the original OSS, CIA, the Dulles brothers, MKUltra, all of that. But again, to go on the other side of the issue, what we do know about, because your quote again, what we know of Jose Delgado's work, what we do know about technologically, about what we might consider the softer areas of mind control, are really remarkable items. I just put a piece up on the website tonight. You'll see it on headlines, and it would be well worth your reading as almost an entree to Jim Keith's new book here, which is, again, is entitled Mind Control, World Control. It's entitled Newly Declassified U.S. Electronic Harassment Technologies. Now, these are things that have been leaked or published that are pretty amazing, and I think the average person wouldn't have a clue. You would know, other researchers would. Aviation Week and Space Technology, that wonderful treasure trove of, in many cases, what amounts to secret technology revealed in pieces. I had a story March 10th, 1997, a year ago. Radar warns birds of impending aircraft. This article by Bruce Nordwall, the Washington Bureau, describes research being carried out and by the U.S. Air Force Wright Laboratory in Dayton, Ohio. The article describes the use of modulated radar signals to produce audible sound within the brains of birds near airport runways to cause them to fly away and avoid collisions with landing craft. This is remarkable. I mean, they're actually creating sounds within the brains of birds at distance and causing them to flee.
Early on, the researchers in the CIA, I'm not sure researchers is the term I'm looking for here, but early on, these scientists were engaged in electronic projection of thoughts, of words, that sort of thing. And in fact, what we do know from relatively recent releases is that this capability was very, very fine-tuned so that words and phrases could be injected at a distance into people's minds. And it sounds like science fiction. Much of the history of mind control sounds like science fiction. But this stuff is gleaned from interviews with researchers and from official documents. It's not at all a kind of raving paranoid interpretation of life.
Right.
It's just a piece of science gone mad that is finally coming out.
It's very true. We have, of course, all heard stories of people flipping out, claiming they hear voices. There is a whole group on the Internet that have banded together. They are still working to try to bring more people in who claim to hear voices all the time. Apparently, many of them are hearing voices. This is not something coming from a filling in your tooth, either pulling in a nearby FM or AM radio station. Be right back. My guest tonight, Jim Keith, as we look into the murky world of mind control. Maybe I should call that taxpayer-supported mind control experiments in this country. Be right back. Talking with author Jim Keith, his books Black Helicopters Over America and Black Helicopters 2, certainly among his most well-known books, published by Illuminae Press. His most current book, Mind Control, World Control. Let's go back, Jim, if we can, to the OSS, CIA interest in this whole issue of mind control. It went back to the days of LSD and actually before that.
Yeah, really, I think the first documented instance of the American intelligence community deciding to delve into the mind control issue was at the end of World War II. We know about George Estabrooks, who was employed in a hypnosis project later he admitted that what this hypnosis was about was creating mind-controlled assassins. Again, it sounds like something wild out of the Manchurian Candidate or whatever, but it's perfectly factual. Estabrooks, a scientist, admitted this quite a bit later. And the CIA and presumably other American intelligence agencies have been involved in fine-tuning those capabilities apparently up until the present day, because even though in the above-ground press there's nary a mention of it, we obtain hints of this. For instance, in people who claim to receive messages in their mind and so forth, and it is verified by such things as X-rays showing mind implants. So apparently the research, the experimentation, simply went deeper, went blacker, went undercover, and is just no longer mentioned.
I've seen X-rays. In fact, I've got some pictures on my website. If you look under Secret Weapons, there was a story quite further back in the archives which does link to a site that at one point at least had pictures of people who had gone in for X-ray, and it right there, folks, a big device planted in their brains, and I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's wild. The MK Ultra issue remains a name that is rather well known, even in the above ground press, as it were. A rather infamous number of experiments. Tell us about MK Ultra, Jim.
Well, Jeff, I don't know. You must be tapped into a higher quality above ground press than I know of, because frankly, I never run across any mention of MK Ultra in Time magazine or Newsweek, or at least very rarely.
Not that high. Not that high.
But
if that's high.
I'm not hearing you.
It is occasionally mentioned here and there. I have seen it, but it certainly doesn't hit the cover of Time magazine, but it's out there a little bit. MK Ultra is a name that has sort of bled through the screen a little bit.
A little bit, yeah, and it is quite amazing. One often hears of such things these days, such as radiation experiments or medical experiments that of a gruesome nature in the past of the American military. For instance, giving LSD to servicemen, but MK Ultra initiated in the early 1950s, right around 1951, consisted of, I believe it was 149 sub-projects and millions of dollars into all facets of mind control. As an example of the type of things they were doing, the work of Dr. Ewan Cameron is particularly dark. It's reminiscent of the Rocky Horror Show without the humor. At Raven's Crag, this kind of gothic facility in, as I recall, it was Montreal, Canada. It might have been Toronto. But at Raven's Crag, Ewan Cameron did experimentation on people who were completely unwitting, had not given permission to be experimented upon, and he would put them into deep sleep for sometimes as long as 200 days, completely drug them out, use what was called psychic driving, in which a command tape loop was played again and again and again for hour after hour after hour, and essentially reduce these people to the condition of vegetables. Now, this was all officially done to be therapeutic. However, apparently no one ever noticed any therapeutic results of turning person after person after person into vegetables. It was like a conveyor belt for creating zombies, just to find out what kind of mind control could be done.
Yeah, indeed. The movie The Manchurian Candidate, said to have been basically made to disappear for about two decades. Wasn't around. Couldn't find it.
Yeah, you know, I believe it was Frank Sinatra who had that pulled, because he thought the issue of mind control was rather touchy at the time of the JFK assassination. There was a lot of speculation that Lee Harvey Oswald was mind controlled. In fact, the director of the CIA at that time issued a memo suggesting that Oswald had been mind controlled by the by the Russians. There are a lot of mind control underpinnings connected to the JFK assassination, but since it was a lone assassin, I laugh up my sleeve. That stuff is kind of irrelevant.
Did you just say what I think you said?
Like I said, I laugh up my sleeve. You know, it's obvious that it wasn't a lone assassin.
Okay, yes, I got it. I hadn't heard the up the sleeve line in a while. Another name that people do not know most is a name that is well known in England, at least to the people who live near it. It's called Tavistock. Sounds like a nice place, kind of like Woodstock.
Indeed.
But it's not.
It sounds quite idyllic, doesn't it? Yeah, the Tavistock Institute was established. It depends on whether you believe the cover story or not. The buzz is it was established around 1921, but it is in the official literature. It supposedly started around 1930. But what this was a collaboration between the psychiatric establishment and the military establishment of England, and it's remarkable. A great deal of the broad mind control projects and so forth, which have been instituted since those early days, have come out of this collaboration of military intelligence and psychiatry. Tavistock is an amazing nexus of world control, let's put it that way.
All right, and the work of Dr. John Coleman, David Icke, and others have pointed to Tavistock as being really the germination point for many of our social trends given to us en masse. Be right back to talk more with Jim Keith. Your call's welcome here. 888-ON-RADIO is our number, 1-888-ON-RADIO. Welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentz. This is Sightings on the Radio, and do drop by the website, www.sightings.com. A tremendous new dose of information up there for you to peruse and think about. More coming in all the time, working on some big stories as well each day and each night. Talking with author Jim Keith, his new book, Mind Control, World Control, is a great one, published by Illuminet Press. We're talking about Tavistock, which is, again, not a summer school. It's something else, and it's been around for about 65 years now, as I recall. It is, according to Dr. John Coleman, David Icke, largely responsible for many of the major trends, social trends, moods, societal moods. There have been remarkable things coming out of Tavistock that have influenced our lives that we may never and probably will never know about. Tell us what you know about Tavistock, Jim, and it's tough to get information from there, but there is some around.
Right. In fact, you know, they are not entirely covert about their orientation. In their official literature, they talk about the contribution, again I say that with tongue in cheek, the
yes.
Contribution of Tavistock is what they call sociatry, which is expanding the role of the psychiatrist from treating individual patients to treating cultures and countries and so forth. And they speak of their practitioners as being shock troops for injecting this psychiatric control into the world at large. It's really quite amazing how straightforward they are about admitting this thing. The basic orientation of Tavistock is something that you're probably familiar with already but didn't know it stemmed from them, and that is taking a patient, either an individual or a country, and bombarding them with negative input, whether it be negative views of their peers or whether it be created chaoses like assassination or created crises.
Sure, and, like a wag the dog scenario.
Right, mm-hmm. In fact. And reducing that person to that person or country to a vegetative state whereby they can be controlled. And again, I didn't get this out of Superman comics. My essential references are straight from Tavistock, and you'll see this echoed in a kind of a microcosm with groups like Esalen or Al-Anon, with these little Gestalt groups and so forth, where people are reduced to blithering idiots, and then reprogrammed for a better self-worth or whatever. But the primary concern of Tavistock is to do that at large, to take countries and to take large numbers of people and, again, totally destroy their self-esteem, totally destroy their sense of being able to function on their own, and then to program them. And that whole theme runs through Tavistock really since the 1930s.
It's amazing how the battle for the mind, as you've pointed out very clearly, is waged on an individual and a countrywide basis by the mass media. And this is not just something that's in the experimental stage anymore. These are hard and fast principles. There's a cause and effect. These things can be set up and turned off and on almost as if you were throwing a switch.
And, you know, it's part and parcel of a very broad program. We see the guys who started Tavistock being involved in Nazism, being involved in eugenics programs, in quotes, for perfecting the perfect man by selective euthanasia and by gene control, this kind of Nazi orientation. It's amazing that towards the beginning part of this century, you see all of these guys involved in this program really for putting in fine-cut control worldwide. It's startling how closely the personnel of the Nazis, military intelligence, the eugenics organizations, the euthanasia organizations, how these guys all collaborated on this worldwide psychiatric project.
It's true. And that was before the real perfecting of electronic delivery means for these various tools, which can be done now, they say, from a truck down your block, a satellite, overflying aircraft, you name it. This was in the days when we had sound and pictures to deal with primarily, meaning radio and television. Transcendental meditation, TM, big, big fad of the 1960s. Some people suggest that that was, in fact, hatched by a Tavistock, if not Tavistock itself. Does that make sense to you?
I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes perfect sense as a possibility, in that
that the kind of thing is turned loose on society, in other words.
Yeah. It would not be an unfamiliar kind of project, let's put it that way. I do know that the guy referred to as the Maharishi, who started TM, who started Transcendental Meditation, was first a nuclear physicist, as I recall, which is a very strange qualification for launching a meditative movement.
Well, his supporters would say it trained him perfectly well for it, so who knows?
Yeah, it could be. But at the same time, whether TM is involved in that sort of thing, we do know that many, many religious and occultic organizations have had that orientation. One famous one that comes to mind, and I'm sure that you're aware of course, is Jim Jones in Jonestown.
All right.
When you look at the personnel involved in launching Jim Jones and his project, it kind of reads like a CIA country club. He received a lot of funding from American military intelligence.
TM certainly may have been a spontaneous movement. Many suggest that a lot of the rock music that came to be such a popular force was a creation, at least the concept of it. It was directed as a social trend from and through the minds of Tavistock.
Again, I think that influence is there. I'm not quite ready to admit that the Beatles, for instance, were were Tavistock agents. Which,
some have actually claimed that.
Dr. John Coleman said that. I don't really see that as being the case, but we see, again, the military intelligence and so forth manipulating these movements. With Haight-Ashbury, for instance, we see the CIA maintaining safe houses and experimentation houses in that area. We see probably the majority of LSD, which flooded the country in the 60s, coming from the CIA. We see...
And the music certainly reflected that hand in hand, that entire drug culture.
Quite so, quite so. And it actually, it does have a rather Tavistockian ring to it to reduce the country, let's say, from a technological orientation to a mystical orientation. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with mysticism. In fact, I think that it's vital to have a grip on both mysticism and materialism to function in this world. But again, it does... 1960s music could easily have been a very, very Tavistock influenced.
Indeed. Certainly, at the very least, we have the potential for managing these remarkable social phenomena like the 60s. Be right back with Jim Keith and your calls, his new book, Mind Control, World Control. It's always amazed me, the discussion about pop music, popular trends and so forth. This issue of Tavistock could well be that of a seed agency dropping these things on, and then the society itself is ripe and it just takes right off. Like dominoes, just kick one over and it goes. The management of these trends is certainly something that is well within the purview of Tavistock and other groups like it. Correct, Jim?
You know, it's... I'm reminded of the metaphor of Danny Castellaro, the murdered journalist. He called the conspiracy an octopus, and particularly in the issue of mind control and Tavistock and so forth, we do see these multiple tentacles. And people at large, do not make these connections because they are so multifaceted, because they invade so many areas of life. But we were talking about the 60s and about the possible manipulation of music and so forth as a mind control device. A couple of things came to mind, which is there is a CIA memo indicating Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead as being
Jerry Garcia.
The late Jerry Garcia as being a CIA asset. Now, as to whether that's disinformation or not, and I know that would be very poisonous to the liberal elements of our audience, it's quite obvious that that the Grateful Dead, with their following and with their promotion of drugs and so forth, did do what the CIA memo suggested, which was to derail political activism and to turn virtually a generation of young people into guys who had more interest in their navel than they did into overturning, a kind of controlling class structure. You know, they really derailed a lot of potential activism by having people dancing in tie-dyed clothes.
Right, right. It went, you're right, it went from largely extrovert to an introverted movement, and in a very short period of time, on balance.
You look at just prior to the psychedelic movement, what we had was the folk movement, which was very much interested in social iniquity and the underdog and reversing those situations in organizing political movements. And then we switched to Timothy Leary with his tune in, turn on, drop out philosophy. Well, Leary himself admitted that he was funded by the CIA.
Yeah. You watch these things come and go, and is it random or is it manipulated? And knowing what I know, I would suggest there's an awful lot of manipulation going on, and it's not too difficult to do, given the amount of control and influence the electronic media has. I mean, the music industry now is all product. It's amazing how these things are marketed and sold. It's just amazing. Someone, you or I, literally could be turned into a pop phenomenon, I think.
Quite so.
Not that I would want to be.
You know, I think it would be kind of fun to have that kind of control and the possibility of getting a message out there. Of course, it's completely fanciful, because if you're put in that position, you're not the sort of person who is going to change circumstances. Certainly, Madonna does not get up on the soapbox and rail against CIA mind control.
No. Yeah, there's still time, though, Madonna. If the issue of MK Ultra, there are a lot of people now claiming to be victims of those experiments, hideous as they were, who are still damaged, who are talking about trying to recover in some way financially from it. I don't know where that's going to go. We have very little means of really certifying these people were victims, but there are a number of them out there.
You know, in many cases, I don't think there's any question that that a lot of people have been victims of mind control experimentation, and a lot of them have launched lawsuits and won against the CIA. It doesn't happen as often as one would like, because generally these people are paid off when they bring these issues to the fore. They're paid off and told to shut up and so mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't become quite as public. But there's simply no lack of documentation about these horrendous experiments, and they continue today. You know, I'm reminded of my black helicopter Milu in 1994, just as an example. In the town of Oakville, Washington, black helicopters did overflies over the period of about 3 weeks, spraying the town of Oakville with an unknown substance. Immediately, almost the entirety of the town became sick with a particularly violent flu. There were also there's a lot of FEMA and military activity taking place in that area at the time. You know, it doesn't sound to me like just like some Asian bug that they happened to catch at the time, because it was raining down on them in droplets.
The number of experiments carried out on the unwitting, unwilling, an innocent American population is formidable, to say the least, and many of these have come to light and are documented. I've got several stories on them as well on my website. Jeff in Portland is on the line, listening to us on KOTK. Welcome, Jeff, for your question for Jim Keith.
Yeah. Did you guys just say that Jerry Garcia was a CIA operative?
There is a CIA memo from the late 1960s indicating that he was. Like I said, I'm not sure if that was disinformation or not.
Well, I'll tell you right now it is.
What's that?
I'll tell you right now it is, because I'm not telling you my name, but I was with them, and Jerry Garcia had nothing to do with it.
Well, that may be, like I said,
you know.
There are many. Let me just jump in with one thing. Jeff, I think you're quite right. Calling someone an asset doesn't mean they're a paid agent. There can be manipulation of people without their knowledge. Jerry was quite clearly his own man, from what I know about him. But the issue of control and influence among the popular culture by the CIA and other organizations, I think, is pretty well documented. I think that's the big point. But thanks very much for bringing that up, and we agree.
Yeah, well.
By the same token, you know, this memo that I was talking about said that the use of Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead was to defuse or to derail political activism. And it seems to me that that is the case. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s myself, and I believe there was a lot of good about that movement, certainly good intentions. But the use of drugs, I do think, tends to, in again, introvert people and to take them off of societal change and into kind of an interior paradise or hell that really doesn't, in the long term, affect the structure of the system.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Again, it's a question of manipulation of the society, of fads. Any influence, certainly, that might have been directed toward Garcia or the Dead could have been done at a level that they were not even aware of above them. Very simple.
And that's my contention.
Sure,
that's
sure.
My contention. It was probably done at a level that they were not aware of.
Yeah,
Same thing with Timothy Leary.
Yeah,
I think he might have thought, hey, you know, this is CIA experimentation, but ultimately it's a good thing. One has to decide for themselves whether it turned out to be a good thing or not.
Well, the puppet masters are more clever than to have direct strings going to lead guitarists and rock groups. It's the message. It's, as you said, the entire milieu of it that really brings home the test results that they're looking. This is all an incredible experiment carried on by a number of agencies in very small microcosmic fashion and on the large canvas as well. And it's almost impossible to delineate and lay it out, but that's what's going on.
And again, you know, what I was saying was on the micro level, the psychiatrists talk about bombarding an individual until they are in a vegetative state for reprogramming. And it's projects like this, which is the mass scale of injection of LSD into the United States, that indeed can put a populace into a vegetative state and ripe for programming.
The incredible proliferation of psychologists, MFCCs, not that they don't do good work and don't have good intentions, is another earmark of a society that has been turned in upon itself in a way that is certainly, in a de facto sense, in many cases, having an effect of, shall we say, pulling them out of focus as a large mass.
And again, you know, the tentacles of the octopus, they make some kind of interesting twinings. You look at the personnel in the American Psychiatric Association back in the 1950s, and you find that about a seventh of that group in the United States were from Germany, from that area, from those eastern countries, and that many of the Nazis that were imported from Germany, about 5,000 of them, after the war, went into the psychiatric establishment and were able to work out schemes that were Nazi in origin, but were whitewashed and then deemed American.
Well, mind control certainly was not an invention of the Nazis, but they did a lot of work to bring it to a state of near perfection. All you have to do is look at Triumph of the Will, that really marvelous creation of Leni Riefenstahl, 1937-38, just incredible imagery. And that was put in the movie theaters and visually, literally mesmerized the nation and certainly impressed many people outside Germany as well. It was really something to see.
You know, Germany in the 1920s, with this sort of cabaret sexual sadism, masochism orientation, there's certainly an argument to be made that that our society in many ways has been turned into the Germany of the 1920s.
Well, all you got to do is hit the internet, and you can see some evidence of that.
Yeah.
If you're not careful. Jim Keith is the guest. His new book is Mind Control, World Control, published by Illuminate Press, and that's available certainly on the internet. What's the phone number for ordering, Jim?
Jeff, I've got to correct you. It's not published by Illuminate. I have done a number of books through Illuminate, but this is from Adventures Unlimited Press. However, you can, the best place to get it, in my opinion, is from Illuminate. Again, it's 1-800-666-8000. 1-800-680-INET, 1-800-680-INET. And the reason I recommend that is that they have all my other works as well.
Sure.
It's a one-stop shopping.
We're going to talk to you in about a week about your newest book in the Black Helicopter vein, Black Helicopters 2, subtitled The Endgame Strategy. Back with more, and thank you, callers, for holding. We'll get to you as we continue tonight with Jim Keith here at Sightings. Welcome back. I'm Jeff Francis of Sightings on the radio, and we are, of course, in the middle of our program. Well, after the first hour, we're not quite in the middle yet, but my guest, Jim Keith, coming up a little bit later tonight. We're very fortunate to have join us on a relatively short notice. I've been trying to get hold of him. Dr. Peter Bregan, M.D., whose book, Talking Back to Prozac, and most recently, Talking Back to Ritalin, just staggered a lot of you listening. We did 3 hours with Peter a couple of weeks ago. And with the recent tragedy in Oregon, yet another shooting, as I'm sure you all know by now, apparently involving Ritalin and Prozac. I definitely want to get a read from Dr. Peter Bregan on this. The parents allegedly also under medication, so we need to talk about this. We will do so coming up a bit later in the program tonight. But right now we're talking with Jim Keith about his new book, Mind Control, World Control, the darker, more convoluted side of it all. We have on the phone now, calling in from Midvale, Utah, John, listening to us on KTKK. Hello, John. Welcome to the program, and your question for Jim Keith.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hey, John. I little comment first. Certainly agree with you. I became you may be familiar with the Executive Intelligence Review and their review of the Tavistock Society and how it really founded psychology and psychiatry in this country.
I am.
There's not much doubt that it's a pseudoscience. And certainly when we end up doping the minds of our kids because we perceive that they're a little hyperactive, we're making a mistake. But, of more import, there are all kinds of mistakes. You were making comments with regard to music. I think largely we could all admit that any time a bad tune, like the dawning of the age of Aquarius, when an industrial rock continues for years past the bad tune's first appearance,
we know
who's controlling it, right? But at the same time, we can look at Jimi Hendrix's rendition of the Star Spangled Banner and I think find music in that. I'd like to preface my question that, the freedom of a rational mind and a reasonable thinking mind is really necessary for discovering and understanding the physical laws of nature and the moral laws in the wisdom of nature's creator. And when a collective society attempts to restrict the freedom of the individual sovereign mind there, then that society restricts itself in discovering and improving and developing. Do you think it's time that we have a proposal for new foundations of our Constitution based on an individual sovereignty and the freedom of a rational mind?
Well, there's a whole program, John, right there.
That's a good question. I tend to think that the idea of revamping the Constitution is probably a bad idea, because I think, in fact, the Constitution is founded on individual sovereignty, and changing the Constitution really opens the door.
I didn't say changing the Constitution.
Okay.
I said adopting. The Constitution had to focus on bringing a republic of states together. That was its principal concern at the time, and it certainly did extend, if you will, the idea that each individual has sovereign rights. And it was the job of not only the federal government, but to an extent the federal government to force the state governments to protect those individual sovereign rights. that's there. It's been lost. It's been lost in giving up a lot to bureaucratic administration and the oligarchy that we've created there.
Okay.
But going, you know, to begin a consciousness in this country, to get away from the entertainment and focus again on what it is that makes America great, a proposal, for establishing new foundations under the Constitution, examining those foundations of individual sovereignty that support the Constitution, and then finding within that how we've allowed it to deteriorate.
You know, I'd say that's been my agenda all along. More than anything, I simply am attempting to orient people so that they're a bit distrustful of control, and so that they become more aware of the excesses that our government has been engaged in, and all of the methods by which their choice and their freedom is infringed. I think that's been my agenda all along.
I do hope you success in it.
Yeah, well, thanks. One wonders, has our freedom been taken away from us as much as we've been enticed into giving it up one way or another?
I tend to agree with you on that. For security, we've been enticed to give it up. But there's an old, there's an old quote there, too.
You bet. The enticement factor, I think, is great. And when one attempts to criticize the way that people are living and suggest that maybe, we don't have our sights set on the priorities, for instance, criticizing the idea of youth culture is for instance, totally wrapped up in music. Is that really appropriate for us to be sort of popping our fingers and talking ghetto patois? Is that really in the interests of the broad public life and in their manner of living? I don't think that really is the key to freedom for most people, to become in this sort of to get into this fashion and music, and in a way, it's the culture. It's the way of the politically castrated.
But the youth culture, which is now king, the culture of young, of pretty, of firm, of tall. I was in the store the other day, and there were university students nearby, and some were in line. They clearly looked and acted like university students for the most part. And the one young lady was with a guy, and she looked at the cover of People magazine, as apparently they all do, and when you're in line in supermarket stands, you can't miss them. And Cher is on the cover, and the girl said, "Ew, what is Cher doing on the cover of People? Isn't she dead yet?" And I said to myself, this is really an adversarial relationship, younger people and older people. And I'm wondering if that might be the next divisive tool.
What do you mean next? I come from, I'm a 60s child. I was graduating from George Washington University in 1969.
Uh-huh.
Okay. We've always got to, don't trust anyone over 30.
Well, it seems to be pretty virulent now and some of the things I've been hearing and seeing. And all the ad agencies are keying on this young, perfect physical form that there's no middle age. Not in the magazines.
Not in some of the magazines.
Some, of course.
But I, I think that we have a fairly broad media for those who are really interested in getting. And I honestly think, too, that I put on some free rock and roll concerts out here. It's near Middell's near Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
I have established these Earth Gems out here. And I only use local music, first of all, local performers, and it's alternative rock. And you find a kid playing with his guitar, and he finds the harmony in the music, and he hears something new in it, and the freedom that comes to him. There are certain principles that come beyond thinking about the sovereign rights of an individual that I think we need to protect, too. But you're right. Let's ignore the industrial rock. Let's stick close to our local music.
Good. Thank you, John, very much for the call.
Okay.
Thanks for being out there. Jim, the idea, again, going back to the number of psychologists, psychiatrists in this country, accident or encouraged?
Well, you know what my book is about is kind of a history of mind control and all of these different fabrics that are intertwined to sort of create a straitjacket for the society. And in terms of the psychiatric establishment, you look at their motives and you look at their history, and it is entirely materialistic. It goes back not to get too arcane here, but it goes back to the late 19th century and the German Prussian system, both of education and of psychology. And their whole thesis was that man is an animal, man has no spirit, and that the correct orientation is to grant the state complete control, and the individual is simply a cogwheel. And I believe psychiatry has furthered that agenda for the entirety of this century through groups, for instance, like the Nazis, through funding by the Rockefellers, through the horrible experimentation of the CIA. In fact, psychiatry and the Prussian school system, which we have, it was always oriented towards keeping the person down, socializing, meaning robotizing them. I don't see that as a healthy thing.
Well, I would tend to agree with you. The issue of pre-programmed mass murderers turned loose in society and then programmed to go ahead and carry out perhaps pre-planned killings to stampede the public, the idea of using that as a tool is one that's pretty repugnant to anyone. And yet there is a lot to suggest that's what's going on. When we continue with Jim Keith, we'll talk about that. Your calls are welcome. A bit later tonight, we're going to be talking and visiting with Dr. Peter Bregan, M.D., about Ritalin and Prozac and what's happening to our young people in the schools around this country. I think you'll be shocked and stunned. We had Dr. Bregan on a couple of weeks ago and did 3 hours on the Ritalin issue, and it was amazing. All that and much more coming your way tonight here at Sightings. And don't forget the website, www.sightings.com. For those of you new to the Internet, even with web TV, you can get there no problem at all. And tons of new material up here. Great new graphic just went up today. My webmaster, James Neff, got one in from a young artist, and we put it up there. It's terrific. Be right back with more in just a couple minutes. Okay, welcome back, everybody, and thanks for choosing to spend your time with me tonight. Jim Keith, my first guest this evening. By the way, Jim will be back next Thursday to talk about Black Helicopters, his new book, Black Helicopters 2, The End Game Strategy. A lot of people don't think there are Black Helicopters, but believe me, after you read Jim Keith's book, there is no doubt. Talking tonight about his other new book, Mind Control, World Control. It is available through Illuminet Press at 1-800-680-INET, I-N-E-T. We're going to segue here, I think, Jim, very nicely into this most recent high school shooting and ask you to describe the technology available to people who might want to do such a heinous thing as programming a human being to go out and commit and an atrocious slaughter like that.
You know, the entirety of the technology is not known to me, of course, because there are certainly a lot of secrets, and that's my job, is kind of uncovering these secrets. But we do know that the CIA, for one, along with other intelligence agencies, has been involved in the creation of mind control subjects and with a particular interest in mind control assassins. Now, this most recent debacle in Springfield, I don't know if there was any kind of overt manipulation there, or whether, in fact, it was this sort of psychiatric orientation of putting people on drugs, of reducing their consciousness. That really is all it would take to create a berserker like that. And we are seeing these berserkers quite commonly these days. there may have been no CIA agent lurking behind behind the screen on that one. It may just have been the use of these drugs to suppress kids' impulses and so forth, and the barrage of information we get. But the but a more fine cut technology does exist, and you see that often in the high profile cases, like for instance Mark Chapman, who killed the rock star John Lennon.
Right.
You see him involved tangentially with all these sort of CIA connections.
Very strange things.
You see him in Lebanon right at the time when the CIA is running an assassin squad training school there. Guys like Sirhan Sirhan, who killed Robert F. Kennedy, which people have suggested might have been in the interest of the establishment to have this kind of radical political figure killed. You see experts attesting that at the time of the assassination, Sirhan was definitely hypnotized. It goes both ways. You do have these mind control. Overt mind control project, mm-hmm. creating assassins, yet at the same time we live in a culture, a psychiatric culture that reduces the freedom of choice, the intelligence of people, and that also can create these berserkers that go wild in schoolyards.
Well, when they watch television for 10 years, 12 years, 14 years, and see over and over again countless times that violence is, in terms of TV, for the most part, an acceptable means of dealing with hurt, insult, or abuse. Don't get mad, get even.
Well, you know, it's part of the it's part of the consumer culture, isn't it? The people who do TV realizes that violence and sex draws our attention and holds our attention, so therefore we are fed a diet on TV saturated with sex and violence. And, you know, seeing that sort of thing, what is it, for 6 hours a day, for 8 hours a day on the average? I don't know what
it is. 43 hours a week.
But it definitely puts a groove in the brain cells.
The issue of mass murder, though, somebody going into what's with all the postal workers? I mean, it's become almost a cliche now. If someone goes postal, they say. There have been a number of these instances. Is there something being done to polarize our society, to encourage and enhance the prospects of total gun control and removal? Is that a possible agenda in the mind control venue that you're familiar with?
Surely. You know, a lot of people have speculated that it is remarkably useful to the agenda of, let's say, the New World Order to have these people going berserk, and this in turn opens the door for a lot of gun control and so forth. At the same time, when we talk about postal workers, it may simply be a society reducing people to the level of a cogwheel and forcing them into an inhuman repetition of activity.
Well, yes, but there are many other professions that would fit that definition as well, I think. And the other issue is maybe we're looking for excuses here where there really aren't any. Maybe it is just a signpost, a marker that this society is, as some say, finished, and it's disintegrating, and terminal madness is beginning to manifest itself for a multitude of reasons, and maybe these are just symptoms.
Personally, I would not choose a generalization like that. I think that there are plenty of specifics, and one of them is that the individual is now seen by the powers that be as being something to be utilized and to be something to be manipulated. And when that manipulation becomes utterly pervasive, the organism goes berserk.
Indeed. This is being discussed around the clock now. It will continue, unfortunately, according to most people who look at the situation. These acts of random, seemingly planned violence. I mean, those kids in Arkansas planned out that event pretty well for two little kids. It's amazing what's going on. No matter how you cut it, whether it's intentional, planned, or another sign of the so-called end times, we are in most difficult distress as a society.
But there are keys, and one key to the people who go crazy and shoot up the schoolyards, as I said, one key is that a high percentage of them are on psychiatric drugs, I think that needs to be trumpeted.
Well, we're going to trumpet it with Dr. Peter R. Bregan, whose book, Talking Back to Ritalin, was the subject of a program here 2 weeks ago. We're going to get to him next. Jim, thanks very much for coming by tonight. This will be a great segue. We'll cover the bases tonight. Mind Control, World Control, the new book by Jim Key. Thank you, Jim. Talk to you next week.
Appreciate it, Jeff.
Okay, good night.
One day soon a song shall rise. You'll hear it with the sleep still in your eyes. You'll wake into a brand new day. And you hear bells ringing, voices singing far away. A time when every man will be as one. A time to reach right out. The sun come the day. Freedom's still a thought within your mind. The fleeting thing that some may never find.
It may be still a million miles away.
Can you hear bells ringing, voices singing?
Cease to blow, a sound I hope that we may never know. We're waiting for the day. Can you hear bells ringing, voices singing far away? Lift up your voices and sing this song. Let the whole world hear it.
Apologies, we've had to cancel tonight's live feed due to family reasons.